I'm also a great lover. I mean, I wouldn't say that. It's the girls that tell me. I hope that not too many of you have heard me before, because somehow my spontaneous outbursts of wit don't sound as good the second time. But I'll do my best in any case. I am standing here before you for some reason as a futurist. And the only reason anyone has to think I'm a futurist is that I'm a science fiction writer, and therefore I'm supposed to be able to peer into the future. And I might say, just very briefly, that I proved this beyond any shadow of doubt, any cavil. Way back in 1952, when I was in Chicago and decided I would visit the offices of a small science fiction magazine called Universe Science Fiction, partly because that was a lot more fun than attending the meetings of the American Chemical Society, as I was supposed to do, and secondly because the editor was really, if I may use a vile term, an editress. She was a beautiful young woman, so beautiful, in fact, that the Science Fiction Writers of America, 2 years running, voted her the editor to whom they would most like to submit. And I knew she would be delighted to see me. She would undoubtedly ask me for a story, and I would say in my suavest possible manner, "Why, certainly, my dear, bring me a typewriter," and overcome by the suavity with which I expressed that desire, she would throw herself into my arms, I reasoned. She did not. She brought me a typewriter, which proves something about editors of whatever sex. Of course, I hadn't been prepared for that. I didn't know what to write, didn't like to let on. So I thought rapidly, and they were preparing to go up Mount Everest for the 8th time. The first 7 had been failures, some fatal. Extrapolating rapidly, I decided the 8th, too, would be a failure, and I wrote a 1,300-word story on why it was that Mount Everest could not be climbed, and my theory was that there were Martians on top. She bought the story instantly. I spent $32. I spent half of it in a fancy dinner for two, which you could do in those days, on $16, brought her back to her room. And for those of you who have a prurient interest in this sort of thing, I didn't get anywhere. I went home, and nothing much happened until May 30th, 1953, when a gentleman to whom, as far as I know, I'd never done a thing, named Edmund Hillary, climbed Mount Everest with a sidekick named Tenzing Norgay, and stood at the very tippy-tip-top of the mountain, they said. Who was there to check, for goodness sakes? And announced that he had neither seen Martians nor abominable snowmen either, even. And now that faced the magazine with a terrible ethical dilemma. Should they publish and embarrass me? Or should they not publish and lose $32? Took them a second and a quarter to decide to publish. And it was published, too, in the winter 1953 issue of Universe Science Fiction, so that I was branded for all time as the man who had predicted that Mount Everest would never be climbed 5 months after. It was climbed. However, things aren't always that bad. I must say, as a matter of fact, I stand before you as someone who has changed the world. Not intentionally, I assure you. But what happened was that back in 1939, when but a mere slip of a boy, I'm still only a little over 30, 1939 puts me well into the negative years, so you can imagine what a slip of a boy I was. I started writing my robot stories. And until then, there'd only been two kinds of robot stories. Either robots were menaces, you invented a robot, built him, and the first thing he did was kill you. There was a moral to that, you understand. You'd think they'd get tired after the 1,000th example, but they didn't. Or else, they built a robot and he was a poor little mistreated thing and you felt sorry for him. That was robot as pathos. And that wasn't as wearisome as the other, because it didn't get used often, but a little of that went a long way. And I decided, the heck with it, robots were machines. So I talked about robots that were simply devices built by human beings to fulfill certain tasks that went wrong, as devices do, and that had to be fixed. And after a while, I devised the three laws of robotics, which first appeared in 1942. I think in March 1942, Astounding Science Fiction, for the first time I mentioned the three laws of robotics, which was interesting because that was the first time in the history of the world that robotics was used as a word. Now, I didn't realize I had invented the word. I thought that that word existed. And indeed, if we were going to study robots, the science would be robotics. Anyone would say that if they just had the idea of studying robots. Because all the subsciences of physics and ICS, you know, hydraulics, celestial mechanics, electrostatics, physics itself, and so on. However, I was the first. I didn't discover that fact for about 3 decades, but since then, I have been telling everybody. To the point where I am now recorded in various dictionaries as the inventor of robotics on my own statement. That is, they always quote, I did so make up the word robotics, Isaac Asimov. In the late 50s, a young man, an undergraduate at Columbia, was fascinated by my book, I, Robot, which contained 9 of my early robot stories and which had been published in 1950. And at least one copy exists in this room because I've signed it a little while ago. First edition, too. Very expensive. If you can steal it, do. And he was fascinated by iRobot, decided to devote his life to the study of robotics, and he did. In the late 1950s, he established a company called Unimation, Inc. in Connecticut. And once the microchip came in the middle 70s, he had it made. He began to develop industrial robots, and they're all over the world now, especially in Japan. And he manufactures, installs, and maintains more industrial robots than anybody else. And I understand that it now pulls in a profit of $70 million a year or something like that. And he cheerfully gives me the credit in writing and in speech for all of it. Keeps the money, but he gives me the credit. That's all right. Money means nothing to a person like me. I'm satisfied with the credit. And as you all know, industrial robots are in the process of changing the world, so that Joseph F. Engelberger, the president of Unimation, Inc., is an important factor in changing the world. And as he admits, he was lured into it and spurred onto it by me, so that I am the person who changed the world. And you would think, therefore, that I would be really onto this sort of thing and be all set with computers, computers being immobile robots, or if you prefer, robots are mobile computerized objects, that I'd be really onto this sort of thing. After all, back in 1950, I wrote something in which I described a pocket computer, very accurately, too. Got the colors right and everything. And since then, people have said to me, Asimov, well, actually, what they say is, Asimov, you jerk. But Asimov, they say, why haven't you patented the pocket computer and become a trillionaire? And I say to them, have you observed, perchance, that I only described the outside? To this very day, I don't know what's inside. Personally, I think it's a very clever cockroach. Well, the fact of the matter is that I have a conservative soul. I've managed to work myself up to an electric typewriter, and somehow I think that's the be-all and the end-all of creation. I admit that in my talks and in my writings, I discuss further and greater objects. But I'm a signpost. I point the way. I don't go there. And people find out about this in different ways. About a year and a quarter ago, there was a new magazine about to be put out called Popular Computer, and the editors thought they would get an article from me with which to grace an early issue entitled, How I Deal with My Word Processor, or something like that. And they said to me, would you care to write an article on the word processor that you are using? And I said, I don't have a word processor. And there was terrible shock, and they left. And I figured, good riddance. Until about a month later, when I found sitting in the middle of my living room, a huge box set on it, word processor. And another huge box set on it, printer. And before I knew it, a bunch of hobbledehoys arrived, took everything apart, put everything together, and there I had a word processor sitting on a table with a printer nearby, and they were busy showing me how to work it, and they showed me for about 3 or 4 hours. And it wasn't too difficult. I didn't understand a word. And they handed me 2 books, each the size of a Manhattan telephone directory, and said those were the simple instructions. Magnifying glass so I could read it, and a set of cassettes encouraging me to read it, and went away. And every morning I would try to work the word processor, and I couldn't get it to do a thing I wanted it to do, not a thing. It stood there laughing at me, obviously laughing at me. It was more intelligent than I was. And each day I would feel incredibly humiliated, and I would go stamping up and down the living room saying, who asked them to send it? I told them I didn't have one. I was happy. I was perfectly content with my life. Now they have reduced it to a shambles. And I kept figuring the only thing to do, since I was far too ashamed and humiliated to call them up and ask them to take it back, was to take it to the window, lean out, and drop it. I'm on the 33rd floor. I figured little would remain. And then one morning, the morning of the day on which I had decided to throw it out the window, I sat down to work it, and the whole thing worked fine. And all I can say is that either my unconscious had worked night after night after night until it finally straightened things out, or else the word processor, hearing my threat to throw it out the window, decided to cooperate. Well, from then on, everything was fine. Mind you, I know exactly as much about that word processor as will allow me to write a book. I don't know anything else. I can't change any of its directions. I haven't the faintest idea how to do a single thing I don't already do. In fact, I came across the necessity of writing an exponent. You know what an exponent is? It's a little 2 above and to the right of the x when you write x squared. And I figured, well, I don't know how to make the damn thing jump up half a space. I tried yelling at it, kicked it a little, nothing helped. So I figured in desperation I'll turn to the directions. And I thought I'd look up the index. The index corresponds to a library catalog. And there was nothing about exponents in the index, nothing. So I figured maybe they left it out. I looked at it page after page after page. Nowhere did they mention exponents. So I called up Radio Shack. I said, I've looked up exponents in the direction encyclopedia you gave me, and they don't include exponents. And they said, have you looked up superscripts? Why the hell don't they say exponents? See superscripts. I looked up superscripts and found out instantly how to do it. And let me tell you, it was no trick at all to figure out how to do subscripts. They can't fool my giant brain. So I'm working away on it. And that's about as far as I've gotten into the world of the future. And yet there is going to be a world of the future, and we can reason it out. I mean, you start off making an assumption. You're going to assume that the world of, say, 100 years from now is going to exist, that Earth will be here, humanity will be here, civilization will be here. Now, we don't have the right to make that assumption. But it's depressing to make any other assumption. So we might as well make this and continue talking. Now, having decided that civilization, which is the most fragile of the three, we can imagine humanity existing without civilization and the Earth existing without either humanity or civilization. But it's difficult to imagine civilization existing without humanity, let alone the Earth. So we will concentrate on civilization. In order to imagine that civilization is still existing a century from now, it means that there mustn't be an all-out nuclear war, that there mustn't be a descent into total alienation, that there mustn't be some sort of such an escalation of violence that civilization will die under a million small wounds. And we must assume that there isn't going to be any overpopulation problem. We are not going to increase our numbers to the point where we simply starve ourselves to death or fight amongst each other over ever-dwindling resources until finally civilization topples. Well, we can avoid nuclear war by simply not having it. We can avoid all sorts of malaises and unpleasantness by simply somehow taking reasonable measures to prevent it. But how on earth do we prevent overpopulation? Well, I'm not going to go into the details. This is not a talk about overpopulation. But I will say that there are only two methods possible. Only two, which is good. If there were 50, we'd never decide which one to adopt. But with two, we have a reasonable chance, one or the other. On the one hand, we can raise the death rate until it's higher than the birth rate. Or we can lower the birth rate till it's lower than the death rate. I defy anyone to figure out a third, except possibly doing both simultaneously, lowering the birth rate and raising the death rate. Well then, both have their advantages and their disadvantages. Raising the death rate has the advantage that we don't have to make any hard decisions. Just keep on doing what we're doing. And in that case, eventually, as the population continues to go up, the death rate will itself go up in order to bring it down. It happens every time. And there have been altogether, I suppose, 10 billion different species on Earth. And every one of those 10 billion, 90% of whom, by the way, are now extinct, every single one of those 10 billion, undoubtedly at some period of time, over some local area, experienced the delights of an abundant food supply and promptly multiplied their numbers and were promptly struck down as soon as the abundant food supply dwindled, as it inevitably does sooner or later. They were struck down by starvation, by the diseases that attacked them when they were suffering from malnutrition, from the predators who themselves increased with the numbers of the predated, so to speak. And therefore, the same thing is bound to happen to the human species. It's sort of natural. Now, there are people who like things that are natural. I understand right now that the advertising word that's most important and most successful and most likely to draw all kinds of customers is the word natural. It used to be new. Used to be cheap. That went away. That cheap, unfortunately, began to sound like low in quality, so they now say affordable. But if you ever hear anyone in any commercial using the word affordable, if you will, in imagination, excise the word affordable and place in its place the word cheap, you'll find that it makes perfect sense. And the only reason they won't use one syllable instead of four syllables is that four syllables sounds not disgraceful. Well then, now they say natural. If something has natural ingredients, you're going to rush to buy it. Strychnine is a natural ingredient, by the way. Most people aren't aware of that. Well, if you go for things that are natural, you're going to love starvation. But if you decide that raising the death rate is not the way out, that leaves you one alternative, which is to lower the birth rate, which means you're going to face a future in which there are going to be fewer children, on a percentage-wise, than before, fewer young people, and more people who are mature, and all the better for it, like myself. And as a matter of fact, this is not something very startling that I'm telling you, because the United States has been experiencing it for the last century. As our standard of living has risen, as technology has advanced, as medicine has advanced along with technology, the life expectancy has increased, has doubled in the last century. And that means that not only the absolute numbers of mature, we now call them senior citizens, something I absolutely detest. I mean, what about those people who aren't citizens, for goodness sakes? There was an old word, one syllable. There's something about one syllable words that people shun. It was called old. You know, I've worked all my life to be old. All my life I've done anything to avoid a situation in which I wouldn't get old. You know, there's only one way you can avoid getting old. And I've avoided it so far. And I intend to try to keep on avoiding it. And I want the respect due all the labor I put into getting these white hairs. I want to be called old. It's a badge of honor. First person calls me a senior citizen, I kick. In any case, there's not only more and more in absolute numbers of old people, but they're larger and larger percentage-wise. And they are becoming a more and more important part of the electorate. Old people can vote. There is no upper limit to voting, as there is a younger limit. And that means that decade by decade, our economy depends more and more upon Social Security, pension plans, Medicare, Medicaid, and all the other fringe benefits to make sure that people who have been working all their lives can, once they've stopped, done their bit for society, get a little chance at having society do its bit for them. Well, then the only trouble is people somehow think of people who are old as weights on the body politic. They don't do their fair share. They somehow consume more than they produce. It's the young people, we are told, who are innovative and courageous and full of ambition and verve and fire and sexy and beautiful and strong, while the old people are curmudgeons. They are no longer capable of change. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. They are always sick. They require a lot of care. They are not worth as much as they cost. And everyone agrees with that, and yet nobody does anything about it because everyone, however young, has the suspicion that someday through some unlooked-for accident he may get old. And he doesn't want to really take it out on old people now just in case he's in their place now. The one great untouchable is Social Security, you know. I mean, no matter how our beloved president keeps slashing away at this and that, he doesn't dare touch Social Security lest people rise in their wrath and destroy him. And I don't mean just old people. It's not just the people who are getting Social Security, but everyone who has the ambition for Social Security. Well then, if this continues, and there are going to be more and more old people, and fewer young people, how are we going to manage to keep our society surviving? We won't starve to death or otherwise destroy ourselves as a result of overpopulation, so we will destroy ourselves as a result of just aging. In place of the bang of overpopulation, we'll have the whimper of aging. In fact, it's less dramatic somehow. Well, of course, the question is it true that old people are such a complete loss? What do we really mean? After all, with the advance of our standard of living and of medicine, people have not only grown older, but it's been a greener old age on the whole. I once wrote a book on Shakespeare, 2 volumes as a matter of fact, Asimov's Guide to Shakespeare. It's now out in a 1-volume edition. I can go into a lot more detail because you're librarians, but I won't. And the very first play I did was Richard II. And the very first line in Richard II is, "Old John of gaunt, time-honored Lancaster." It's Richard II speaking. And as he says that, on totters John of gaunt, time-honored Lancaster, aged approximately 115, made up to look that way. And you think, oh my God, how can anyone be that old and still live? And all through the first and second acts, he represents an old man speaking in a quavering voice, and he dies in the second act, I believe, after talking about England. So it happens he was 59 when he died. That's not very old. I remember when I was 59. It's not old at all. We speak of old Abe Lincoln, and we have a feeling this patriarch of all he was, when he died, he was 56. Heck, he was years and years younger than Reagan was when he became president. So the point is that being old is not as old as it used to be. And you might say, well, yes, medicine might keep you hale, but for goodness sakes, the mind, it decays. It loses all its ability to innovate, all its insight, all its creativity. Does it? Or do we create that? After all, we have education designed for the young only. Kids go to school. As soon as they're old enough to have managed to write their name without misspelling it more than one time in 3, we kick them out. We say, that's enough. You don't have to be in school anymore. And what's the result? The result is that there's no child in school so young, so stupid, that he doesn't know that he's in school only because he's young. As soon as he's old, he'll get out of school. And what's the result? Every child wants to be grown up. He wants to be old so that he can eat all the candy he wants, so that he can cross the street when he wants to, anywhere he wants to go, so he can play ball all day long, so he'll never have to wash again. I mean, every kid has these ambitions, and he knows it's all he needs to do is to wait and get old, and he'll enjoy them, become a grown-up. And the one sign of being a grown-up is you don't go to school. As long as you go to school, you're a little kid. Once you're out of school, you're a grown-up. So naturally, every kid longs to drop out. Every kid, if he's the least bit annoyed with school, and who can go to school without being annoyed once in a while, just feels the ambition rise to get out. And he associates school with learning things, so that once he gets out of school, he never wants to learn again. Doesn't want to read another book, doesn't want to think another thought, doesn't want to have another idea. Why should he, for goodness sakes? That's kid stuff. I mean, almost any grown-up, if you ask him, what's the capital of Paraguay? Or, before the recent unpleasantness, where are the Falkland Islands located? Would simply stare at you. And you'd say, didn't you learn that in school? He would say, sure, I guess so. Then how come you don't know? Well, why should he know? When he was young, he wore diapers. That doesn't mean he has to wear them now. And so we gradually, through our very system of education, our association of youth with education, we create a population which, by and large, actively doesn't want to learn, actively doesn't want to do anything mentally, so that naturally, as you get old, you get curmudgeon-y, and you find yourself set in your ways, you find your only knowledge of the world, or of anything at all, is some vague memory of what you learned in your teenage years, and you create a nation of Archie Bunkers, by and large. And the question is, what are we going to do about it? Obviously, we must dissociate learning from kid stuff. We must persuade people that learning is a human activity that continues as long as a human being remains human all his life. And would he do that? Most people would suppose it's dreadfully dull to be learning things. That's not so. Every human being is perfectly willing to learn if it's something he wants to know, even if it's a girl's phone number. I mean, this is widespread throughout the living world. There is no species of animal sufficiently advanced so that we can imagine that we are understanding the emotions it feels, where we don't see that if it does that which it is well adapted to do, it enjoys it. No one can watch a seal swimming without seeing perfectly clearly that the seal is having fun swimming. We imagine that any bird which is soaring through the air without much trouble in the way of flapping its wings is enjoying the sensation. We can't help but suppose that a cheetah running down its prey or a racehorse running around the track rather enjoys the effort. This is what it was made to do. Well, then what on earth was a human being made to do? The one thing a human being has that no other creature has, with the possible exception of the dolphin, I suppose, is 3 pounds of the most complexly organized hunk of matter that we know of. The human brain is the most inordinately complicated bit of matter that we can imagine, or that we infinitely more complicated than the star is. That's why we know so much about stars and so little about the brain. And this brain must be used. It can't not be used. To anyone who is accustomed to using it, there is no disease more painful, more immediately wearisome and unbearable than boredom. People will do anything to avoid being bored. My own feeling is that people who steal hubcaps do it because it's better than doing nothing. And all we have to do is make it possible for them to use their brains. But do they want to? Sure, if it's fun. Well, why shouldn't it be? Right now, when you go to school, you have kids there in classes, 30 to a class perhaps, all studying under a similar curriculum, all having to learn a particular subject, particular details of that subject, on a particular day, at a particular speed, being able to answer certain questions. And it so happens that maybe for some people the rate is too fast, for others it's too slow, for others it's in the wrong direction. There's got to be very few kids who just happen to be interested in the things being taught in school and who find the rate of learning just suits them, neither too fast nor too slow. The bright kids study outside or get bored. The not-so-bright kids get frustrated because they don't understand, and in either case, the results are sad. And yet, what can we do? Where are we going to find a way in which we can somehow teach each kid at the rate he is best adapted to and in subjects that most interest him? And here, I suppose, is where the computerized world is going to come into its own. Now that we have the microchip, it is perfectly possible to imagine computer programs which have all kinds of libraries of information contained within their memory systems. What's more, with intelligent, well, I hate to use the word intelligent in connection with them, with quasi-intelligent access to it, making it possible for people to ask questions of the machine and to receive answers, to receive references to books, to pamphlets, to cassettes, to all kinds of information-storing material that it can reproduce perhaps if the person wishes, that it can then go off, it can branch off in different directions depending upon what interests a person. Every person can then learn what interests him to learn at his own rate, at his own time, in his own way, in the privacy of his home if he wishes, and he will end up enjoying it. That is the key point. He will end up enjoying it. Now, we have so far had very primitive examples of this sort of thing. We have had little machines which will tell you if you're right or wrong in answers to simple arithmetical equations. How much is 8 and 7? And if you say 15, it'll say, good boy. And down in Baltimore, I understand, on one occasion, a certain school had the unusual experience of having pupils break into the school on the weekend. Not in order to vandalize it, which was what always had previously happened, but in order to play with the machines some more. They didn't get enough in school. You can't make me believe that all those kids really were dying to know how much 8 and 7 were. But they wanted to have the instant appreciation. They wanted to have the feeling of competitiveness, the feeling of achievement, everything that somehow it is impossible to give them under present circumstances. Well, you might say, but how is it possible that everyone should learn what they want to learn and yet have people know how to do the work of the world? If everyone is going to learn just what they want to learn, we're going to have millions and millions of American kids who will learn everything there is to know about baseball and nobody who's going to learn anything about physics. Well, I'm not sure about that. It's never been tried. We can't be sure. But I have a feeling that if kids really wanted to know about baseball and continued asking questions, that a certain percentage of them would become fascinated by the notion that a ball can be thrown in such a way as to curve and want to know why. And if they really want to know why the ball curves, they're going to find themselves, to their own surprise and perhaps delight, veering into physics. And it may be they'll abandon baseball for the greater delight. If no one tells them that physics is dull and hard, if they approach it from a direction which they consider fun, they might find it amusing and easy and delightful. We don't know. It's never been tried. And even if relatively few people move into physics in that fashion, we actually don't really need that many physicists. We certainly don't need as many physicists as there are baseball fans. So that I think things will work out nicely. I think we will end up with a fine mix. And as a matter of fact, in this world of the future, we are not going to need so many people anyway doing all the dirty work of the world. We're going to have more and more computers and robots to do all the scut work of the world. And we're going to need human beings to do what human beings do, which is to be creative. As a matter of fact, this is the very essence of the problem that's going to face us in the century ahead, which is, as computers get cleverer and cleverer and more complicated and learn to do more and more things that human beings have been doing, will there come a time when human beings will be outmoded and unnecessary, and where computers will do everything, and they'll be all that's needed, will be replaced. Now, there are two possible ways of looking at this. I mean, where do I stand on the possibility of computers replacing human beings? One answer is, why not? Sort of cynical, you know. You figure, we all know the story, the drama of evolution as it is presented by biologists. We start with very simple cells and unicellular organisms for hundreds of millions of years, maybe a couple of billion, and then finally multicellular animals evolve, and you have all kinds of invertebrates, and then chordata evolves, and eventually we have the fish, and some fish manage to crawl out on land and become amphibians, develop into reptiles with eggs that can be laid on dry land, and the reptiles develop birds and mammals, and the mammals develop into one of their groups, or the primates who specialize in brains. The primates get larger and brainier. Pretty soon come ape-like beings, which give rise to modern apes, to hominids, the precursors of man, and finally we have Homo sapiens. And in all this, it's a wonderful drama with us cheering on each step, until we come to Homo sapiens. Then we say, stop. Why stop? I'm sure that the reptiles wanted to stop at the dinosaurs. It could be, if you want to look at it, that the whole purpose of evolution was to proceed by very slow processes of hit and miss and chance mutations and so on, taking millions of years to make some perfectly simple advance, taking billions of years to produce finally a creature with a respectable brain. And then finally, when after over 3 billion years, you have a creature with a respectable brain, perhaps that was in a sense, the purpose of the whole thing. Because once Homo sapiens exists, there's no need any further to go through that long, long, long system. Instead, we are now capable, either through genetic engineering or through material technology, to create something beyond human, either out of ourselves or out of our computers. And we create the next step in evolution. So what's wrong with that? We have no right to perpetual rule over the earth. Who gave us the right? Well, that's one answer. I don't believe it. I believe another one, which is that who is to say that there's only one kind of intelligence? You know, this is something that's taken for granted. Intelligence is intelligence. It's a one-dimensional sort of thing. You measure it with a ruler. Here's the extent of intelligence that can exist. How intelligent are you? How intelligent am I? How intelligent is the next guy? How intelligent is a chimpanzee? Well, you measure it, and you get a number. 115, 80, 75, 160. That's the IQ, the intelligence quotient. Doesn't occur to people, apparently, that there can be different kinds of intelligence. It occurs to me because I'm an expert at taking intelligence tests. I always end up with an incredibly high figure, which makes me seem, on this one-dimensional measurement, to be a genius. And I allow it to continue because I make my living out of having people suppose I'm a genius. But if you promise not to tell people, I'll tell you a secret. I'm not. I have infinite proof that I'm not. For instance, my word processor that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk suddenly wouldn't work. Wouldn't work. I called up Radio Shack and said, send over a guy, fix it up. They said, do you have a maintenance agreement? I said, no problem. Send along the paper with him. I'll sign it. They said, that's not the way it works. Come down here and sign it here, and we'll send it to Texas. They'll approve it and send it back. Tomorrow morning, we'll have a guy over. What could I do? I said, I'm coming right over. They said, bring a blank check. I brought a blank check. I happened to have a supply at home. And they told me to make it out for $1,400. So I did. They had me. I made out for $1,400. The next morning, a guy came in, and he turned on the wall switch. They didn't give it back either. Now I ask you, is that the act of a genius? Something goes wrong with my car. There's not a thing I can do. It may be that all it needs is to have one screw tightened. And I have a screwdriver. Won't help. I have to bring it down to the garage where a young man with an IQ of approximately one-third of mine looks at it, tells me exactly what's wrong while I gaze at him as though he is a creature of godlike intelligence, which he is in that particular fashion. In fact, I remember once in the old days, a garage mechanic said to me, "Doc," he said, that's what he called me. I think he thought it was my first name. "Doc," he said, "a man who was deaf and mute walked into a hardware store and he wanted some nails. Well, he couldn't say what he wanted, so he just put out his hand like this and went like that. And they brought him a hammer. And he went like that and he went like this. And they brought him a selection of nails and he selected what he wanted and left. And I nodded my head. And he said, now next, a blind man came in and wanted scissors. How did he ask for it? So I said. He said, no, Doc. He said, give me some scissors. I can see from the laughter that you all fought the way I did. That a disadvantage is a disadvantage. There are no distinctions between them, right? So I laughed, and I said to him, have you been asking everybody who comes in today? And he said, yes, I have. He says, how many did you catch? Oh, he says, 50-50, about half. I knew I'd catch you, though. And I said rather haughtily, how did you know you would catch me? He says, well, Doc, because you're too goddamn educated. And I think he was right. All my intelligence has been channeled into tricky ways of answering questions on intelligence tests, you know, so that it turns out that I am considered intelligent by the people who made up the intelligence test of exactly the same kind of intelligence. And all the other important people who have really important sorts of intelligence, like common sense and how to fix things and ingenuity around the house, they're all dismissed as morons, which is wrong. Well, then granted that there are undoubtedly various kinds of intelligence, different genuses and species, genera and species, and so on, what makes us think that a computer would have the same sort of intelligence we have when we know darn well it doesn't? Already the simplest electronic computers, the first electronic computers devised, were incredibly better at solving arithmetical problems than we were. They could manipulate numbers so quickly and so inerrantly. That's a good word. Without error. Whereas human beings were always making mistakes, and it took them forever, because that's not what the human brain is designed to do. Arithmetic is always slow. Get the most intelligent people, and they labor over 79 minus 24. You'd think that it was a world-shaking problem, and they get the wrong answer almost a half the time. And this is pi to the simplest computer you can imagine. Does that mean the computer is more intelligent than the human being? No. Solving those problems is nothing. It's not important. It's no measure of intelligence. And anything else a computer does so far is no measure of intelligence by human standards. And it may be that as we make computers more and more complicated and versatile, we'll have them doing more and more things that human beings shouldn't be doing in the first place, because it stultifies the brain, the human brain, and leave to us what we are specially adapted to do, which is to make the daring intuitive leap, to make the creative combination of widely separated pieces of information, to look at a problem, face an amount of information which is totally, totally insufficient to afford us a solution, and guess at a solution which is close to the real thing that a computer couldn't do at all. I mean, Newton guessed that the density of the Earth was about 5.5 grams per cubic centimeters. He had his own units. Grams and cubic centimeters weren't invented till a century after his time. He hadn't the information required for it, but this made sense to him. Well, a century later, the density of the Earth was measured. Came out to be 5.5 grams per cubic centimeter. How did Newton know? Easy, he was Newton. That's how he knew. I write stories. I write them very quickly. Since I write them very quickly, you can be sure that I don't have time to either think about them very much or look at them very much when they've been finished. I'm busy with the next one. As I said to a beautiful young lady at the luncheon table today, to be prolific is to be an imperfectionist. Well, if I don't have a chance to think much about it, how do I know which word comes after which? What sentence comes after which? How do I start? How do I end? All the rest of it. I've never given it any thought. I haven't the faintest idea. I just do it. But I don't know how. And I couldn't teach a computer how, even if I were a perfect programmer, because I don't know how. It may be that someday we can work up computers to the point where they can do these human things of creativity and intuitivity. But why? They are so good at what they do, that why not keep them doing that and leave us at what we're so good to do and have two broad classes of intelligence, the computer and the human, marching into the future together, doing together more than either could do alone. Well then, if we are to envisage a future in which learning becomes highly personal, in which it becomes lifelong, in which we really computerize and robotize the world, and yet don't have conflicts between humans and computers, but have them work symbiotically together, then we've got to ask the details as to how this is going to be done. Obviously, the computers are going to have to be programmed so that there'll be appropriate teaching machines. And the people who program are going to have an idea of what the wisdom of the world consists of, what the knowledge of the world consists of, how it is organized, how it is best fed into the computer, how it may best be tapped. In short, the people who can run the computers who will educate the human species will have to be people with the very qualifications that people who run these library catalogs have. It is the catalogers whose life work it is to organize the knowledge of the world and to learn how best to retrieve it when desired, how most economically to retrieve it, and how best to use computers to make the word work simpler and more efficient. And it will move forward from library cataloging to computer programming to the supervision and maintenance of the teaching machines of the future, to becoming, in a sense, the key personnel involved in the conversion of the human species from what was to what will be, and make such a huge difference that people, from the vantage point of a few centuries, looking back, will say that everything up to the year 2000 marked the infancy of the human species, and that only afterwards did we enter into adolescence and adulthood. I'm just a little too old, perhaps, to survive to see the fullness of the change. But those of you who are younger than I am, and much as I hate to admit it, represents most of you in this room, you will be able to see, and certainly before you come to shuffle off this mortal coil, you will know for sure whether humanity is moving in this direction and whether it will be a successful species, or whether it will allow its short-range goals of kick your neighbor in the eye to win out with civilization clearly on its way to toppling. And I hope that we will succeed, the species as a whole, making use of the skills which you are developing without perhaps having seen the same vision I have, and that we will move forward And then, if that happens, and if I'm not around, as I may not be, sniff, sniff, it'll be nice if someone finds out where the hell my ashes are scattered, comes over and shouts, "We made it, Asimov!" Because maybe I'll hear, who knows? And I'd like to know. Thank you very much. No absolute necessity to do so. There are two reasons why there might not be any questions. One is that I've been so luminously clear that there is no one who feels that there's anything to... On the other hand, I may have been so luminously dull that people are only too glad to have me stop altogether.
I would just like to pass on the story to the Edmonton Public Library.
Oh, please do.
We opened our online catalog 2 years ago, and we had only one terminal up in the children's department the first week to train staff. We did it in children's because it was quiet in the daytime. We deliberately left the terminal on all day long. The children watched staff learning and figured the whole thing out for themselves with no instruction sheet. They played a game that week they've never bothered to play again. They wanted to see what author brought up the most entries. The Internal Revenue Service brought up under only 115 entries, but Isaac Asimov brought up 205.
Well, as I sometimes say, some people write good. I write a lot. One librarian, I remember the day, it was November, it was the day after the 1968 election. I addressed librarians in southeast Massachusetts and Foxborough, Mass. One librarian told me afterwards that in her branch, my books were the most frequently stolen. I like to think it's not because the people who like to read my books are more thievish of disposition, but simply because they can't bear to return them. Shall we let them go?
No.
Oh, okay.
Father Teilhard de Chardin, he was a Jesuit as well as a well-known paleontologist. In his crystal ball gazing, something which you have done, he has roughly pointed out the direction, saying that so far the evolution of human being or human race has been in the physical domain, from a flat to upright structure, and partly in brain also. His prediction roughly are the domain he calls the domain of oosphere.
Pardon?
Oosphere. O-O-S-P-H-E-R-E. This is the...
Yes, I see.
Oosphere domain, he has said. Roughly what you are saying is, to an extent, computer is an extension of human brain, human mind, and, I mean, that has been partly evolution also, in the sense that if human energy can be extended by steam or electricity and do that, computer tools, to an extent, is an extension of human mind, doing something outside which human mind cannot store, cannot process, a computer can do that. My question to you, and part crystal ball gazing, is also whether that experience will result in better brain in some direction, or the linear brain you were describing will stay on that level. You sort of foresee some superhuman race of some kind, a bad direction possible, or what is to an extent kind of possibility.
That's very interesting. Thank you very much. The question is whether I think, as a result of computers acting as an extension of the human mind, I foresee a, quote, superhuman, quote, unquote, race in the future. Well, that's an interesting thought, because as the computer itself becomes more and more complex and versatile and can do more and more things, there is bound to be a better understanding, I think, of intelligence as a whole, and perhaps by the use of computerized methods, we may be even able better to understand what I might call the wiring of the human brain and how it works, so that we can, out of a position of strength and knowledge, proceed to use genetic engineering techniques to improve human intelligence. In other words, it won't be a question of building ever more advanced computers while retaining human beings exactly as they are now, but it'll be advanced computers and eventually advanced human brains too, each sort of being the result of the success of the other, leapfrogging each other. And that would be very exciting, but it's difficult to look into that future because I'm not sure what the results of a super brain might be any more than it would be possible, I suppose, for a chimpanzee to imagine what the feelings of a human being would be like. All I can say is that I think we might be able to have our own evolution proceed more rapidly than before. And while I dread what might happen, I am also sort of excited at the thought. Yes, sir.
Well, most of the people here are involved in constructing library catalogs. I would assume that you're a very heavy user. I'm just curious if you'd comment about your experience as a library user, and more particularly as a catalog user. What kind of problems or fun or adventure you had?
Well, you heard that. What are my experiences as a catalog user? Well, here I'm going to have the same sort of fundamental and incredible embarrassment as I had when I was asked to write an article about my word processor. Since I started earning money, I've been buying books and creating my own library, and I've got in my two rooms enough books to give me all the information I need for my articles. If I don't have the information, I either don't write the article or I bend it a little. Pardon me?
Are they organized by author or subject?
Oh, they are organized by subject. I have a bookcase for mathematics, a bookcase for chemistry, physics, astronomy, biology, history, and then I have various encyclopedias and stuff. I have one where I have books on literary miscellany and so on. But mostly, and I hate to say this, mostly the catalog is in my head. I know where each book is and what's in each book. And so that whenever I want something, I find it without much difficulty. But then, you see, it's a very specialized thing that I do. If I had to find things that I knew less about, I would be forced to go to the library, use the catalog, and then I'd have all sorts of interesting stories to tell you.
Extending the car catalog to the building of the library, or the library itself, what is your mental representation of the library in the next 25 years?
Well, I think that we will never get rid of books. I know that the reading of books is a minority activity, but it always has been. My feeling is that reading is difficult. We don't think so because we're used to it, but we represent a minority. I think we feel that almost everybody is literate because our measure of literacy is the ability to sign your name, to read the large letters that say no smoking so that you might ignore them, and things like that. But supposing you judged literacy by the ability to read 1,000 words of small print, with ease, it might turn out that very few people were literate. I've never really ran a test. I just this feeling I have. So that I'm not concerned when people tell me so many people watch television and don't want to read. I have a feeling that if the television didn't exist, they would stare at nothing rather than read. But now, supposing we improve television, made it better and better, supposing we had cassettes, which we now have, that we can put into our television set and see anything we want. And